Then partly sunny and warm for the afternoon. Today's high, 83. Right now, nice little breeze from the west at 8. Sunshine and 68 degrees in both Kenosha and Racine.
And on today's morning show, we're so pleased to welcome back to the program our good friend. Welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And on today's morning show, we're so pleased to welcome back to the program our good friend Nan Calvert, who joins us on the monthly basis and typically brings with her a very interesting guest or guests to talk about some kind of issue related to the environment. And today we're going to be talking about a topic near and dear to Nan Calvert's heart. I'm not sure there's anything nearer and dearer to her than the whole idea of native plants, and in this particular case, native landscaping. So first of all, Nan Calvert, we welcome you back to the morning show. And before we introduce our guest, Danielle Bell, I want you to say a word about how you came across Danielle and what she does.
Well, there are, good morning, everybody, by the way. There are a couple of things. I am known to periodically check in and see what native landscaping firms we have in southeastern Wisconsin and the Milwaukee area. So that's sort of my fun, I guess. And I came across Danielle's firm, Native Roots. And I was intrigued especially by her website because front and center, it has the idea of native landscaping for traditional lots, for smaller spaces. And I can say after having been involved with native plants and native landscaping for quite some time now, people still have the idea that it can only be done in larger spaces. But that really isn't true. It never really has been true. Although sometimes municipal ordinances do work against us, that's changing very slowly. It's imperative that we begin transitioning from our typical turf and non-native landscape approach to something that's far more life-giving and certainly kinder to, water conservation, soil conservation, and species conservation. And I think most of us know, of course, now that the monarch butterfly, who's long been the flagship of, you know, getting people interested in the natural world, is now listed as endangered, which is really a rather heartbreaking thing. So that's why I wanted to have Danielle on and talk about what she does and how she does it and get people fired up about it.
Very good. So our guest, Danielle Bell, is the owner of Native Roots, which is based in Glendale, Wisconsin. And we're going to be finding out about all of the work that they do and try to get people thinking outside of the traditional box in terms of what kind of green and blooming things to have in one's own yard. And Nan, just to expand on what you were saying, I think what you're talking about is that I think you're saying that a lot of people think of, in terms of fostering native greenery, we think of that as something where you, if you have a meadow, an empty meadow, that's a place to have that happen. And we need to start thinking about doing that even in our own yards.
Absolutely, because you can. There are so many different kinds of native plants and, creating habitats, creating sort of smaller ecosystems within a traditional suburban lot is absolutely possible and doable, and I hope that we can encourage people to do so.
So, Danielle Bell, we're so glad to have you here. Thank you for making the trip from far off Glendale, not that far, but anyway, we do appreciate you making the trip here to our studios. So, ahead of us talking about what Native Roots is all about, tell us a little bit about where you come from and maybe a little bit about what got you interested in the natural world around you and in doing this kind of work.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is exciting. So I grew up in a rural town in Beaver Dam, just north of Madison, and grew up on a farm in the country, always playing outside. My parents encouraged us and kind of pushed us out to be outside, exploring the natural area. We had a creek running through our farm, so always down there. My dad just, you know, always showed us to be careful and compassionate to nature around us and encouraged us to enjoy the critters, the landscape and everything. And then my mom was really big into gardening along with my grandmother, so that got me into kind of manipulating the landscape a little bit by planting and bringing new plants in. Unfortunately, when I was younger, we were doing a lot of the ornamental and exotic plants, and then now I've transitioned over into doing things that support our ecosystems and encouraging wildlife to use the landscape and not just something to be looked at from afar and to be feared, as some people can see the landscape.
So tell us about creating Native Roots. When did that happen and under sort of what circumstances?
Yeah, so I owe a lot of the creation of Native Roots to my husband because he kind of pushed me and encouraged me to do it. I had been through a couple different landscape firms, some focusing on ecological landscapes, some not so much. So I took pieces of all of those experiences, and my husband's like, just do it. He's like, people, like friends had been reaching out to me for help with their landscapes, and he's like, you have the clientele, you have the drive, and you have the need out there. People are looking for this now, and there's not a lot of firms. Like Nan was saying, she's looking at who's new for native landscaping, and it's becoming a lot more, I don't want to say trend-setting, but it is becoming a lot more common that there are more people out there. So I think I got in at the right time. In 2019 was our first season, and despite some other circumstances that have happened since then, we have not slowed down. We have had a lot of great clients. We've had a really good backlog on work, so we are steamrolling ahead and transitioning and transforming a lot of landscapes.
That's great. I noticed on your website that in terms of at least the traditional season in which you do a lot of your work, that you're completely booked up.
Yeah. This year I actually had to stop taking on new clients back in May because I was just getting so many referrals and so many inquiries about doing it, and I just don't have the manpower yet to make that work. So we're just doing what we can and, you know, trying to transform as much as we can, getting rid of that turf grass and bringing in natives.
Wow. So as problems go, that's a really nice one to have.
Yes.
Fantastic. So first of all, tell us a little bit about what the typical transaction is between you and a given customer, and in particular, a brand new customer that calls you up, assuming your docket isn't completely full and you're able to do something for them. Talk us through the typical transaction and kind of that journey that occurs.
Yeah, I'll say probably half of our clients have already started dabbling into bringing native plants into their landscape, and they do it with the mindset that they want to provide habitat and those keystone species for certain insects, monarchs. You know, we have to have milkweed in our landscape. So they kind of had that idea. They just don't know how to arrange the plants. And that's where I kind of come in to help them design a landscape with the native plants that may not be as, I hate to say the word messy, but as a neighbor who doesn't have that mindset might think the landscape looks unkempt and neglected. So what I do with them is I walk around their property, kind of see what they have going on, what kind of site conditions they have, soil, sunlight, moisture, and then I kind of start to talk about, oh, we could make this into like a wet area that we could have, like, say, for example, by the downspout, we could make a little rain garden here, and we could have species that like to have their feet wet over there. And, oh, you have a really sunny spot over here, so this is where we could have a nice short prairie area. So we can start to make ecosystems or microclimates on their landscape, and then we start to transition that with either focusing on doing a whole design plan for the whole property. That way we can have goals to move forward. It doesn't have to be all done in 1 year. I tell people that all the time. Budgeting and time is always a restraint for people. So we do it, you know, whatever you want to do each year. But having that overall design plan helps them see what the landscape is going to transform into and give them that drive to keep going and a nice cohesive plan. So we kind of focus then on one area, and we transform that each season, and then the next year we come in and do another area. And I also have a lot of clients who want to do the work themselves, which I think is great. I help them, give them the plant list, give them the design plan, and they dive in head first and do the planting themselves. And I think that really connects them and makes them want to care for the landscape and see it through, whereas if sometimes if you're a little more hands-off, you don't have that instant gratification of, I did that work and I want to see this succeed. And then it kind of can become neglected. Not all the time, but sometimes.
Sure. So are you saying that even in a, let's say, a typical city lot, I mean, because some city lots are still pretty palatial in their dimensions, but are you saying even a fairly normal, modest-sized city lot, one might actually think about all those different things you were talking about? I mean, assuming that it is that kind of a situation that calls for that, but that those kind of things are even possible in those kind of spaces?
Yeah, a lot of people think that urban landscapes are so disconnected from nature and that it's all concrete and all asphalt and the only thing that's going to grow is turf grass. And that's not true. We have a lot of natives that are very tolerant of poor soil conditions, actually. Most of them are. And we have short species. We don't have to have 8-foot tall cup plants as our only option for our plant selection. We have a lot of great low-growing ground covers and woodland plants that will all do really well in urban environments. And we can use the buildings to create those microclimates. So like on the north side of the house where it's shady from the shade of the house, that's where we can have our woodland garden. On the south side, that's where we can have our prairie. And I already mentioned, like, next to the downspout or a sub pump, that's where we can have our wetland plants. So you can kind of create your own little microclimate. Yeah, it's not going to be 10 acres or more, but even in a quarter acre property, you can still have a huge diversity of plants. And maybe those species, like, you won't get a sandhill crane or an eagle nesting on your property, but you'll get animals that can stop over during their long migrations. We talked about the monarchs, you know, they're traveling from South America and Central America, and so we're making those areas where they can stop and feed and rest, and then they can move on to their next space, especially with our migratory birds. You know, they're all herding, and we need to have these stopovers. So even if you're not seeing them nesting year-round on your property or being there year-round, they're still using it and it's still essential to them.
We're speaking with Danielle Bell, who is owner of Native Roots, a company in Glendale, Wisconsin, which engages in native landscaping for homeowners and for businesses, I would assume, as well. And Nan Calvert has brought her to the morning show today for us to kind of talk about this. Let's talk about the matter of turf grass, a dirty word certainly in Nan Calvert's dictionary. And Danielle, I'm curious about the alternatives, but first, maybe Nan, just say a word about why turf grass is such a source of consternation and concern for you and for a lot of other people as well.
Resource consumptive and not life-giving, that's why. So when you think about the typical American lawn, it's something that we've been tricked into thinking is the thing to do. Unfortunately, it isn't. One reason is that it's very short, dense vegetation, and the root system is very short and dense also. And so it does absolutely nothing for water infiltration. In fact, it increases stormwater runoff. And so actually, snowmelt and rainwater aren't supposed to run directly off into the nearest receiving body of water like they do now. It's actually supposed to go back down underground, infiltrate slowly, end up in the underground aquifers, and eventually bubble up to the surface at some point in time and then become surface water again. Particularly in urban environments or densely populated environments where there's such an enormous amount of impervious surface like pavement and roads and rooftops and sidewalks and driveways. In a very real sense, turf grass is also an impervious surface. So once you start decreasing that and replacing it with native plants that have amazing root systems, so there's so much going on underground with native plant ecosystems, whether they're naturally occurring or they are introduced or reintroduced into an area, you begin to decrease the amount of stormwater runoff and help it go back down underground. It's resource consumptive because we keep watering it and fertilizing it and mowing it and mowing it and mowing it and, putting all kinds of chemicals on it that make the soil very unhealthy. Soil is supposed to have things living in it, things that you can see with your eyes and things that you need a microscope to see. And all of those things that we pour on it to get rid of quote-unquote pests that bother our turf grass make the soil very unhealthy. So, again, not to belabor a point, which I do, I know, but native plant root systems also nourish the soil because a percentage of them die back every year to be regrown again, and that nourishes the soil. So there are so many reasons to begin replacing our traditional turf and non-native plant lawns. I could go on and on, and I, again, know that I do on occasion, but those are two of them.
Right. Well, and it's an important point, then. It's kind of at the foundation of so much of what we want to talk about today. So Danielle Bell, for somebody kind of entertaining the thought of discarding the traditional turf lawn in favor of something that would be more native, what are the possibilities that are out there? And are any of those possibilities anything that even remotely resemble a normal lawn, if you will?
Normal. Conventional.
Conventional, okay.
Yeah, I would say, though, the biggest thing that would look most similar to a turf grass lawn would be doing something like in our shaded areas, using Pennsylvania sedge is a really great one that it literally just looks like turf grass, but it's a sedge, it's a native plant, likes the shade, so it's not going to be something that you can put out in full sun. We don't have a whole lot of short grasses that would be something that you could easily swap out. There is buffalo grass that can tolerate being mowed, but a lot of our grasses and our native plants, they can handle like a mowing or two a year, but that's pretty much it. So we don't have something that we can like easily just one for one swap out. But just creating landscape beds, you don't have to take away your whole lawn. But if you take away a third of it or a half of it, you're going to do so much benefit to the soil, to the microbes. You're going to attract so many different things to your landscape, birds, insects, pollinators. And you can leave the turf grass, and a lot of our designs, we leave it as a walking path. So that way you get to walk around your landscape. It looks intentional and not a weedy mess to the neighbors or the people who are driving by or walking by. But our woodlands, our shady areas and our properties where nothing else grows, putting Pennsylvania sedge that can grow in like the densest shade. Wild strawberry is another really great ground cover that, your grass isn't growing, so let's put something there that is adapted to and tolerant of those shady conditions and using woodland plants that way.
Hmm. So if one were to, first of all, assuming that one would at least cut back the conventional turf grass in favor of some of what you were talking about, describe kind of how that gets planted and also how that gets nurtured, because as Nan was saying, the traditional turf lawn, for one thing, absorbs tremendous time and resources in order to be nurtured. What about these native plants that you're talking about serving this particular function? What does it take to, first of all, plant them and then to make sure that they stay vibrant and alive?
Yeah, not much once you get them established. There's not a lot of maintenance that you have to do with them. So first you want to get rid of the turf grass, whether that's through smothering methods using cardboard and mulch, or you can use a sod cutter to kind of get rid of the top layer of grass. You can also use plastic to smother as well. That takes a little bit longer using solarization, or you could use, maybe if you are okay with it, with a chemical application, just a one-time deal just to get rid of that turf grass is another option for people who want to go that route. But we do a lot of smothering, especially with the cardboard and mulch, because then it looks like a bed already because you have the mulch out there, and then you just got to wait a couple weeks to let the cardboard break down a little bit so then you can put your plants right into the mulch and the cardboard and plant them right into the ground. Then after that, it's usually, if you're doing perennials, we say like about a month of watering every other day, every couple days, depending what time of year you're doing it. In the spring, temperatures are cooler. Fall, temperatures are cooler. We usually get a little bit more moisture. In the summer when you're doing it, like right now, we have clients who are watering almost every day just because we've been so dry with their new plants. So you want to make sure you get those guys established really well. And after that first season, that's pretty much all you have to do. You can cut things down in the fall or the spring to tidy things up a little bit. You don't have to be too tidy because those messy areas with the debris on the ground, the leftover plant debris, the detritus, that's where our insects overwinter. And then when they overwinter there, the spring migrants have something to eat, and they pick through. I get thrushes through my yard, and they're shuffling their feet around to kick up the little insects in the spring that they're eating, and giving them that energy to keep them moving along to their final nesting spot. But yeah, during the growing season, just maintenance on making sure that your weeds are kept under control. So that's where it's enjoyable for people to go out. You get to pull a few weeds here and there, but you get to see all the life that's using those plants. See the monarch butterfly flying by, see the caterpillar on the plant. So the weeding no longer becomes a chore. It becomes something that you get excited to do because you get to go out there and see what's blooming now, what's using my plants, what bees are on there. And yeah, like I said, for fall cleanup, you don't really have to do anything. And in the spring, we usually tell people you can cut things down to about 18 inches, leaving some stems because we have some insects that nest. I have little mining bees that will nest in the stems that are hollow, and other mining insects will go into those and raise their young in there. So you don't have to be a super cleany, tidy person. You don't have to get that leaf blower out and get every single leaf out of that bed. You can leave it, and that becomes your mulch then for the next year. So you don't have to go and purchase another truckload of hardwood mulch to then put the time and labor on your Saturday to put it down. You can actually enjoy the landscape.
When it comes to, for instance, trimming things back, typically how do people do that? I mean, with what do you trim back?
Yeah, if it's not too big of an area, usually a hand pruners is all you really need. You can also get a string trimmer. We have some of those battery-powered ones that are really efficient nowadays. So you can just go and just take the string trimmer, knock it down, take... If you wanted to pick up some of it, you can take it over to your compost pile. But yeah, you can just trim it and knock it down. You can also, if you have a larger area, if you do have the space to do a prairie or a meadow, you can always just mow it too. Just mow it on your highest setting for whatever type of lawnmower that you have.
We're speaking with Danielle Bell, who is the owner of Native Roots, located in Glendale, Wisconsin, and her firm specializes in native landscaping. And so just now we were talking about some possibilities in terms of replacing the conventional, traditional turf lawn with something that is native. And of course, as Danielle was just saying, one possibility is if you just can't bring yourself to eliminate the conventional turf grass altogether, that you can scale that back considerably, and that will make a difference for the better as well. So let's talk about pretty blooming things. I mean, in terms of replacing the conventional choices people tend to make when it comes to the flowers in their yard. Maybe Dan, Nan, back to you for just a moment. Are the concerns you have about a conventional turf grass, are those the same concerns when it comes to the typical flowers that we most often plant in our yards that are not native?
Right. So non-native flowering plants tend to live shorter lives than our native forbs or flowering plants. And their nectar, research has shown, I'm not making this up, research has shown that the nectar they produce is in far smaller quantity and far less quality than native nectar from flowering plants. And when you, you know, native landscaping is all about relationship. And to emphasize what Danielle was saying, when you decide to put in a native landscape and you do it all yourself or in part yourself and you care for it yourself, you enter into a relationship with it. You're in communication with it. Whereas so often non-native or conventional landscapes, they're just for looking at. You know, they're ornamental, and it's not a relationship with the soil, with the air, with the water, with the things that need those to survive. The other thing is our native animals, whether it's an insect or it's a chipmunk or whatever, they have evolved right alongside, part and parcel, with native plant ecosystems. So they're hardwired to know what they need. one of the reasons that we have generalized and precipitous species decline is because their habitats have been destroyed. So generalists are surviving. They do what they need to do to survive. It's not necessarily the best for them, but they're trying to hang on. But when you replace those with the things that they know, the things that they need, you're also helping them to survive and thrive. With the volume being turned up about our native pollinators, it's such a good thing because now people realize, oh, I could help native pollinators survive if I put these plants in or this, that, or the other thing. If I change my habitat, I can give them what they need to thrive and survive. And of course, we know we can't live without our native pollinators. So yes, I there have always been concerns about non-native landscapes, and research has shown that our concerns are certainly validated.
Absolutely. So Danielle, let's turn our attention to kind of this facet of landscaping and talk about some of the things that you suggest to clients and can offer them in kind of the native realm.
Yeah, so like Nan was saying with the specialist and versus the generalist, when we do our plant selection, we always try to get some of those specialist plants in there because by doing that, you are providing for that insect that has that only relationship with them. For example, I'll just keep using the monarch, but there's so many other insects that have very close relationships with a very specific plant or family species. And then when we plant for those, so if we put milkweed into the landscape, yes, we're providing for those monarchs to lay their eggs, let their larvae grow, and complete their life cycle. But we're also providing for so many different bees, different solitary bees, bumblebees, ground nesting bees, which are not all bad. They get a bad rep. there's a lot of native ground nesting bees that will not sting you unless you are really taunting them.
Yes, unless you give them a reason.
Yes. But so when we plant for those specialists, we're providing that keystone plant that they need to survive, but we're also providing for the generalists too. So if we, you know, put in the milkweeds, we put in the blazing stars and these other plants that help monarchs, we're not just helping the monarchs, and that's great that we are, but there's so many other insects that are benefiting as well. And then on kind of the reverse side, Doug Talamy is a huge mentor of mine, but he talks about how oak trees can provide for over 500 different species of Lepidoptera, which is your moths and your butterflies. So when we plant one oak tree, Like, if that's all you do in your landscape, you are creating habitat for over 500 insects, and you probably won't get all of them in your yard, but you have that potential to have that much of an impact with just putting one plant in the ground. So you can go as small as you want and still make a huge impact.
Right. By the way, do you deal in trees or just smaller plants?
Yes, so it depends on the scale. When we were talking about urban landscapes, a lot of people already have trees well established. Most of the time they're not native, unfortunately, but we try to put trees and shrubs in. Shrubs has been kind of my big emphasis this year because so many birds depend on that middle layer of the canopy structure for nesting sites. So we tend to take out in our parks and in our home landscapes, we take out the shrubs because we don't want to have blocked sight lines. We don't want to have those obstructions where funny business could be happening. But those plants are so essential. They provide so many different berries for our birds and smaller mammals, and they provide a huge source of pollen for a lot of our pollinators when they're in flower. So having those shrubs in there is probably where we focus more so than trees, but we do put quite a bit of trees in into landscapes too.
And with regard to our native shrub species, they're really quite beautiful. You're not going to see them in conventional garden centers, but many of them have just amazing fall color, berries, just great winter interest as well. So, yay, native shrubs.
Yeah, all right. Let's talk about trees for a moment. You were saying that, unfortunately, a whole lot of trees that are out there are not native, although I suppose they still serve certain functions and so on. But what would be the most important examples of trees that are native and that, you know, as far as you're concerned, should be people's first choice when it comes to adding trees to their property?
Yeah, so like the top, you know, and this is going back to Doug Tallamy, so if you have not heard of him, I really encourage you to Google his name. He has a lot of great YouTube videos out there, a lot of great resources and great books that are very well written for the homeowner who may not know the scientific background of a lot of the plants. And that's what I really love about his written work, is that it makes it digestible for even the common person who is just getting into native landscaping and the importance in it. I guarantee you it will change your mind, because I would say 90% of my clients have mentioned that I read his book and now this is why I am reaching out to you. Mm-hmm. So he's a really great influence and really pushing for people to get the natives back into the landscape. So going back to his books, he has a lot of lists in his books as well that talk about what species provide the most benefits. So we have our oak trees, our Quercus family. We have like 6 or 7, I'm sure, probably maybe even more native oak trees. So there's an oak tree that you could probably find that would fit your landscape. They're going to be a little bit bigger in the Midwest. So it's definitely like a mature canopy tree, but it still makes an impact even when it's a smaller tree. You can still see a lot of insects using it. And then going to our birch trees and our cherry trees, the Prunus family, those are all really great plants, trees that will provide the most benefit. And when I say that, I mean they're providing the most food source, most habitat for the biggest number of insects. But even if you put in a hackberry, you know, hackberry is a species that I think it has like 1 or 2 butterfly species that will use it, but it has berries that the birds love. So you have a lot of different birds during fall migration that will be stopping by to pick on those berries and eat those. And talking about the nutrient source of the nectar of our native species versus our ornamentals, that goes to the same thing as our tree species and our shrub species. Our native nuts and fruits are packed with protein that will help get our birds south healthily and give them the energy to make that long migration, whereas a lot of our ornamentals like honeysuckle and buckthorn that have been spreading over the landscape, those are just sugar bombs, and it gives them a nice quick burst, but it doesn't give them enough energy to actually make their full migration. So they have to consume a lot more, which takes up energy as well. So having our native trees, that's giving them the protein and the fat reserves that they need to either make it through the winter or make it through migration.
Very good. Your eyes lit up, Nan, when she mentioned, what did you call it, hackberry?
Hackberry. It's just a beautiful tree. And the bark is really interesting as well. And the fruits that it produces are edible by humans. So many benefits for native trees. But with global warming, with climate change, shade is essential. Now, shade has always been an essential part of any habitat. We often don't think of it as part of habitat, but it's even more critical now. I mentioned impervious surface earlier. Rooftops, sidewalks, roads, freeways, driveways, all of those paved things are heat islands. In other words, they catch that heat and reflect it back up. And so, you can go to any parking lot on a 90-degree day, and it's just so much hotter and more uncomfortable. Shade is essential to mitigate heat islands and help to give some respite not only to humans but to the other living things that we share the planet with. So, yeah, plant those native trees. And they're so beautiful. You know, we're used to seeing non-native trees, quote-unquote, street trees. Yeah, hackberry actually is one of my favorites.
Very good. We're speaking with Danielle Bell, who is owner of Native Roots, located in Glendale, Wisconsin. And Nan Calvert has invited her to be on the program today to talk about the work that she does with native landscapes. And in particular, native landscapes in smaller spaces, including typical city lots and business lots, for that matter, and the difference that it can make. We kind of got off on trees, but I want to circle back to things that are flowers or look like flowers, and have you make some suggestions of things that you think are especially beautiful and especially effective in this kind of native landscaping.
Yeah, so some species that we really like to use again, there's so many out there, but using early species that will bloom when the bumblebee queens are coming out. So things like Virginia bluebells in shadier gardens, even prairie smoke, passiflower. These are all species that will tolerate being in an urban environment. One thing to kind of be aware of is maybe like if you put salt down next to your driveway or your sidewalk, like that's where we want to kind of be a little bit careful on what species we select, because some of these can't tolerate that. But that's maybe where you have your buffer of grass, and then that also helps prevent any floppiness of the native plants that might, you know, lean over onto a sidewalk, especially if it's a public sidewalk. So those are really great early spring flowers. Some summer flowers. I mean, there's a lot of color in the summer. Hoary vervain is another favorite of mine. World milkweed is a really great one, and that one spreads and becomes a ground cover. So that kind of helps to be your green mulch and your weed prevention by, you know, using some of these plants and their method of spreading or their habit. We can use them to our benefit so that we get to spend more time looking at them versus weeding around them. Planting densely is another great way to do that too. And a lot of our common, you know, black-eyed Susans, purple coneflowers, things that have been in the trade and in the industry for a really long time because they are so beautiful, we just want to make sure that we're using the native species versus cultivars of them, because there are some research, not, you know, 100% on everything, showing that it's 100% better to have the true native species versus a nativar or a cultivar. But in my opinion, like, let's just not try to justify it. Let's just use it what has been around forever. And those evolutionary connections and relationships that insects have, like, let's just trust that that's the best way to go about it, and go that way. And then when in your fall, you want to have your asters and your goldenrods, and these get a bad rep because they do spread through the landscape a lot. What I tell people to do with them is after they're done flowering and there's no longer any nectar source, just cut them back, cut the flower heads off, and so that way you don't have the seed flying around and spreading to other beds that maybe you don't want it to. But goldenrod does not cause hay fever. It's not the reason why you're sniffling and sneezing in the fall. It's a really important plant to help our overwintering gynes, which are the bumblebee queens for the next season. They helps them get their fat reserves so they can survive our winters. It helps the monarchs and red admirals and other migratory pollinators get the energy to get them to a warmer place. So we need to have those asters and those goldenrods. And there's a lot, too, that don't spread so much by rhizomes and by seed. So a lot of our shadier areas, you can use a zigzag goldenrod or elm leaf goldenrod are two of my favorite mm-hmm. to use that don't take over the landscape, so to speak.
Hmm. By the way, do you see any drawback if somebody, for instance, would like to step decisively in this direction, but, for instance, on their back patio, they have a couple barrels and that's where they plant their pansies and their, you know, other things like that that I don't know if those are native, but I mean, you know, more conventional things you would find in a garden center, but they're planted in barrels versus not in just the soil around your house. Mm-hmm. Is there any problem with doing that?
No, not at all. The one thing that can be a little tricky is just that you should still bring those containers into either just a garage or your basement for the winter just to help protect their roots because they are a perennial, and when you have them above ground, they are more susceptible to the freeze-thaw that we go through in the winter, and especially if they're a dark pot, you know, they're going to warm up even on those cold winter days, and that can damage the roots a little bit too much. But I had a friend who she had just a rental property, and so all she had was a little balcony, and she had a blazing star, and she sent me a picture with, like, 10 monarchs on it.
Oh,
so,
that's
you know, it's possible to do even container gardening with native plants, and you are going to attract, again, you're going to be that stopover. You may not have things nesting in your property with just container plants, but you will be providing that stopover, that little snack. You know, just think about you taking a road trip and you want to have that nice restaurant to stop by versus a gas station full of junk food. So,
right, there you go. And what about if you have containers that are not native? But then what you're planting in the actual soil is native. Is there a problem with doing that kind of mixing in a sense?
No, not in my mind. Some people are purists and they want just to use native plants, and that's fine. I tell people if you have that peony or you have that, you know, connection to a plant from your grandmother had it and it's sentimental value, but it's not a native, like, as long as it's not one of our invasives or potential invasives, I tell people, like, you can still have exotic ornamental landscape plants in your landscape, and it's not going to negatively impact the benefit that you have with the native plants.
Gotcha. So, I'm just trying to think about ways to make this palatable for people who are just kind of by nature are going to kind of shy away from this as though it is something that is only a kind of a drastic thing that they're just not ready to do, but mm-hmm. that if there are ways in which people can step in this direction and become more comfortable with it, and then one hopes over time step even more decisively mm-hmm. into this. We don't have a lot of time left, but I want to give you a couple of minutes to talk about also edible landscaping. I noticed on your website that is one of the things that you like to get into, and what do you have people sort of think about in terms of making choices about this?
Yeah, I mean, edible landscape, that's not something that we focus on 100% or have a lot of expertise in, but using our native plants, there's so many different ways. A lot of people just think about the nuts or the fruit of plants, and that's great. Most of the time you have to fight or beat the animals to them, like elderberries and service berries. Those are all really great plants that have really high nutrition value in their berries and their fruit. But there's also a lot of plants like nodding onion where you can eat the bulb or you can eat the early greens of a lot of different plants. And that's where, you know, people say, I want to have an edible landscape. And I'm always cautious. I'm like, well, what do you mean by edible landscape? Like, I can give you a bunch of these plants like onions and some different coneflowers, but you need to be willing to harvest them at a right time and use them the way that our ancestors who originally were on this land, how they used them. So that's kind of where I, you know, want to understand where the client is coming from. Because, yeah, if you just want to have berries, like, we'll plant service berries and we'll choke berries and all this other stuff. But there's a lot of different herbaceous plants that you can use as edibles, too.
Very good. Nan, I can give you time for one question for Danielle, if you like, before we have to finish up.
Do you propagate your own plants?
Yes and no. For myself, I do. I've tried. I don't have a greenhouse. I think if I did on my property, that would be a lot easier. But yeah, we use local native nurseries to source most of our plant material. And then, like, for friends, I usually have people come over and say, hey, I have a bunch of natives that have seeded themselves. I don't really want them here. I don't want to pull them because I don't want to get rid of them from the landscape, but I want them to go to a new home. So I have a lot of friends and family who take my little seedlings and give them a new home and give them a new start.
Oh, good.
Wow. You've given us a lot to think about today, Danielle Bell, from Native Roots of Glendale, Wisconsin. How far is your scope of activity in terms of your clients?
Yeah, so we stay in southeast Wisconsin, focus mostly on Ozaukee, Milwaukee, Waukesha, and then Racine County. But if you're looking for just design, plant ideas, or something like that, we're willing to go a little bit further, but we try to stay as local as we can so that we're not spending more time on the road than in the field working on landscapes.
Absolutely. Great. Well, we certainly encourage people to seek out your website to find out more information about what you do and of course, what you offer. It looks like, is it Native Roots Designs? Or what is the address?
Yeah, it's nativeroots-designs.com.
Nativeroots-designs.com. Very good. And Danielle Bell, the owner. Danielle, I'm so glad that Nan extended the invitation to you, and we're so grateful to you for making the trip here to WGTD to share all your thoughts about how people can bring the beauty of native plants into their residential landscapes. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Nan Covert, thank you so much for the idea for this program.
My pleasure.
I know you have a couple of announcements before we go.
Yes, there are a couple of important announcements. Pacas and Pints at the Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center. This is the final Pacas and Pints fundraising event for this year at the Eco J, and that will be on August 25th from 5 until 8 p.m. Registration is required. Just do it on the Eco J website. But keep in mind, attendance is limited. The cost is $30 for people over 10 years old. It's free if you're under 10. Food will be provided by Specialty Nacho Queen and music by Rare Privilege. Next, a really important event in southeastern Wisconsin, Walk in the Woods Art Fair at Hawthorne Hollow, September 10th. That's from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. This art fair has become one of the most popular and well-respected in southeastern Wisconsin. There will be over 50 artists displaying their creations in the woodland trails and gardens of Hawthorne Hollow, so you get to have a lovely stroll. Fine art ranging from jewelry to painting, photography, wood sculpting, glass, garden art. It'll all be available for you to drool over and purchase. Live entertainment will be there throughout the day, face painting, food and beverages, silent auction. It's a $10 donation per vehicle that's requested, and hopefully everybody gets to go. It's a really wonderful event.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Nan Calvert.
You're welcome.
We look forward to seeing you in September.
Yes, I'll be here.
Very good. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation about one of the greatest athletes of the 20th century, Native American Jim Thorpe. We'll talk with David Marinus, whose groundbreaking book is titled Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. Looking ahead to Monday's morning show, I'm honored to welcome into our studios the Poets Laureate of both Kenosha and Racine. Our weather forecast is for sunny skies this morning, a few clouds this afternoon, high of 83. Partly cloudy overnight with a low of 63. Tomorrow should be mostly sunny, at like today, a high of 83 degrees. Right now, the forecast Saturday is for mostly cloudy skies and a 70% chance of rain with a high of 78 degrees. Partly sunny Sunday with a 50% chance of rain. And this is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.